Welcome to the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we have discussions about how leadership and organizational culture impact organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes.
The Culture and Sports Podcast is brought to you by Culture and Sports.
Culture and Sports helps sports organizations, teams, coaches, support and front office staff, and athletes understand the importance of leadership and organizational culture and its direct impact on success. I'm Jeremy Piasecki, the Executive Director of Culture and Sports.
And I'm Sydney Moore, a former Division I volleyball player and CEO of Thrive Insights, a sports consulting firm. Please join us for Season 6 of the Culture and Sports Podcast.
Welcome back to the Culture and Sports Podcast. I'd like to introduce you to Sydney Moore. Sydney and I met when I reached out to her to ask her a couple months ago to be on one of our culture roundtables to discuss NIL and just the impact of college sports in general. And through our discussion on the culture roundtable, I realized that there's something incredibly special there. And I wanted to invite Sydney to come back on and to co-host the entire Season 6 of the Culture and Sports Podcast. Before we start into this podcast, Sydney, I'd like to introduce you, which I already have, and I'd like you to kind of talk about yourself a little bit.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Yeah, so I'm Sydney. I just finished up my fifth year of collegiate volleyball at Syracuse. I originally played at Cornell for 4 years before doing a grad transfer. I was one of those COVID students that lost their freshman year of eligibility. And throughout my time at Cornell, I got really involved with student-athlete advocacy, specifically around gender equity and Title IX. Actually helped to introduce a bill around Title IX reform called the Fair Play for Women Act into Congress around my sophomore to junior year. That kind of catapulted me into the industry in general and winning some really cool awards like an ESPY and one of Glamour Magazine's Women of the Year. And it really just snowballed into an added passion that I already had for athletics and for student athletes. But all those experiences really taught me how this could be something that I do forever and something that could be a career. So doing, you know, things like the Cultural Roundtable and now podcasts like this, I have a podcast of my own, has kind of become my life's work in a way. So I love having conversations like this and really excited for this series.
So one of the things that we talked about before we started recording were the different topics we want to discuss during this entire season. And one of the things we want to talk about is the era of the dumb athlete is over. Can you go into that a little bit more for us?
Yeah. So like I said, I got into advocacy really naturally, like throughout my college experience. It was really just from things that I was noticing or things people would bring up. And then I would ask more questions and want to figure out how I could solve this or how I could learn more and get more involved. And that has really turned into this like kind of value I have around student athletes specifically, but athletes in general, being part of the industry beyond just going to practice and playing in games and maybe getting an NIL deal every once in a while. And so that, you know, the idea of the dumb athlete is over, I think, has been something that's always been in the back of my head. But I have to actually give the credit to one of my mentors here at Whitman at Syracuse. I was talking to him about my podcast and just kind of explaining the ethos of it and trying to get his perspective on the podcast as a business. And he was the one who said it first. Hey, like, this is a really good idea. You know, the era of the dumb athlete is over. People always used to think athletes should just shut up and dribble or just, you know, stay in their lane. And what you're doing is kind of giving student athletes an opportunity to learn more in a really nice packaged way. And so that's been something that I've kind of taken with me over the last couple of months and something I think is a great first episode for a season all about mainly, you know, the college sports landscape changing and just culture and sports in general, like we're talking about.
Yeah, and let's kind of get into that a little bit. So there are a lot of coaches out there who'll be like, your job is to be an athlete. And that was true back in like, you know, way back in the day, you know, even the 60s, 80s, 90s, you know, the 2000s. And then, you know, I think over time, things have changed, right? And so, you know, yes, your job as the athlete is to show up and to learn and to practice and then to perform at a high level, whether it's an individual sport or if it's a team sport with your teammates, right? But there's more to athletes, you know? And so what does that mean to you as the actual athlete, where if I'm an old school coach and I'm like, you know, your sole purpose here is to listen to what I say and to do it how I want you to do it, that's not your perception. Please explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, I think it really goes into kind of how things have changed around sports in general. It used to be kind of like clock in and clock out, and sports may have just been a hobby or just an added thing that you did, right? Before, when, you know, people weren't really buying tickets and you didn't have a ton of fans, before there were brands trying to partner either with athletes or with teams or with, you know, big organizations, before student athletes had social media and fans and people who followed them, yeah, you're just here to play and we're just here to win and that's the only goal. But as we've seen with the professional leagues and now with even NCAA and honestly even high school and club sports, there's more attention and more opportunity put on the sports world in general. And so that adds to the role and the opportunities for student athletes. I would really view it. I'm in business school now. I'm getting my master's in marketing. We talk about opportunities and blue oceans all the time. When as a student athlete or just as a even a professional athlete, originally, like MLB players were making like $6,000 a year because no one was going to the games. It wasn't a big industry. But now they look around and they see, hey, you guys are making money off my name and my image, or you guys are selling, you know, tickets and all these different things. They also see that opportunity and they want to participate and do more. It's just like a natural curiosity as well, rather than just the money. When you see more things happening around what you're doing, you want to do more. So right. It's kind of crazy to say like, hey, your job is just to play the game. But it's not, because after the game, you're asking me to do interviews and you're asking me to volunteer and you're asking me to show up early and put all this work in. It's natural to get curious.
Yeah, no, those are some great points. And I know that there's some, you know, team owners or colleges, universities, or even high school programs who are like, we're the ones who are bankrolling all of this. We're the ones who are paying for practice facilities, for, you know, game day facilities, for uniforms, for, you know, all these other things, right? They're putting in all the money, they're putting in all the effort, and you're just coming in and, you know, showing up to play a simple game or a simple sport. Why should you get something more than you just getting paid or you getting a free education? Or if you're a walk-on athlete at a college or university, you're getting the benefit of just being part of the team, I guess. You know, what do you say about people who wholeheartedly believe that you're there just to execute what it is the team wants you to do and you shouldn't be making money based off of your participation on a team or in a team sport or in an organization that is training you in an individual sport?
Yeah, this is such a layered response, because I feel like when I first answer this, my first answer, you might assume a specific thing about what I believe, especially based off the news and athletes suing and all the different people who are speaking out. It's a really layered response and perspective for me. First, I recognize the value of a full scholarship for the athletes who do get that. My mom was a student athlete at Northwestern. She played basketball, and she says all the time that she probably wouldn't have been able to go to a college as great as Northwestern if it weren't for a scholarship, or she would have gone somewhere closer to home. And so that is an amazing benefit, but we still have to look at how the industry is growing and the overall changes when we make these comments. Getting a full scholarship is amazing. And I think that's where a lot of people who maybe don't participate in college sports or have a loved one in college sports kind of maybe misunderstand student athletes. We're not saying that our scholarship isn't valuable. We know the monetary value and we know that people want something similar. What we're just saying is when you take a step back and you look at the entire industry, hey, maybe we're not getting a full fair share. I think a great way to look at this like too is like, when you work at a company, right, they pay for the benefits or different resources that you get at that company, right? If you have to go to an event and you need a polo or a pin, they pay for that pin, same as your uniform you're representing, right? If you need to travel for a conference to represent the university or work for your company, they pay for your flight and your airfare, your hotel, and all of that. It's the same thing for student athletes. And I think just because we are young, because that might not be a normal experience for college-aged people to be traveling, to be getting food and all these different things, that can be seen as a luxury that is extra and that we don't deserve, when it really, I think, is a base, it's a base thing. And it also, if you think about it that way, sets up the foundation that student athletes, in a way, are providing a service or working for the university in some way. And what really makes it that we're providing a service, that we're working for them, is the revenue that we're bringing in. And it's different for all different sports. You could talk about revenue generating sports, you could talk about women's sports, but in general, we're providing a service for the university for the fact that they're able to then use athletics as a draw in to get people to apply for the school and all that kind of thing.
When I was a young athlete, I didn't get opportunities like this. So why is it fair that now you as young athletes are getting these opportunities to go way above and beyond the opportunities that we had when we were younger athletes?
You know, you might argue that it's not fair. I don't think I can defend that necessarily. I mean, a great example is, I remember when I was graduating, I went to Cathedral Catholic, a great school in San Diego, Southern California, huge in volleyball, huge in most sports, really. But I remember it's like we were number one in the country my senior year, and we spent almost the entire season like in like kind of a guest locker room because they were redoing the volleyball locker room. And I'm graduating, and I come back over the summer just to see it, and it's sick. It's, like, totally tricked out. And I'm like, this isn't fair. How do you guys get this? I've been working this, and this is never fair. You know, and, like, same thing. I graduate Cornell, and they add all these different resources. It maybe it's not fair, but you have to recognize that things naturally improve and get better, and that there's always this constant cycle, right? You know, when you were playing, there were probably other resources and things that were so much more important to you that you were asking for. You asked for them, or someone, you know, advocated for those. Those got changed, and now there's new things that people are asking for. And so there's this idea of the fairness. It's just never going to happen. There's also just natural innovation and ideas that's happening. And I really think that that's what's happening with the sports industry in general. It's what's happening with college sports. People are recognizing the opportunities and improvements that can be made in college sports to make it more of a business, to be honest. And, you know, there's a small section of people out there who are identifying ways who can make it better for the athletes and more equitable as well. But as those opportunities are found, yeah, there's going to be more resources and more benefits and different things that come up as well. And that's really what, again, that I mean by the era of the dumb athlete is over. As you identify
this. And athletes are evolving.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and this goes as more revenue like grows for teams and organizations. But not every single time there's more revenue, it equates to athletes getting something more, or even coaches or support staff getting more. But everything's continuously evolving. Can you share a little bit about some of your thoughts about the evolving athlete?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things really is social media, which also was a huge driver for NIL, name, image, likeness, and also a huge driver for a lot of these new leagues and opportunities for athletes that are popping up. First, you have, you know, it was really hard for athletes to come up with solid ways to say that they wanted a piece of revenue or that they wanted monetary benefits as student athletes before social media, because the only way for them to get that really was these specific deals with brands or local, you know, hey, we're getting food, or I'm putting on a camp, or different things like that. But how do you market that, and how do you track the impact? You aren't really able to track these influencer marketing kind of deals until you have social media, where you can see exactly the views and the reach and the engagement rate. other than that, it really would have been like ticket sales and jersey sales, which you have to ask the school directly for. In my opinion, it's really like this digital age that gave student-athletes or gave athletes in general so much autonomy and opportunity. You can kind of test at home and see, hey, like, how many followers do I have? And that can directly show you, hey, how many people in the stands might be coming specifically for me? Then you can start to calculate that. You can start to take advantage of it. I think a great example, too, is with the tennis tournaments, and Naomi Osaka had the super kind of famous, you know, kind of butting of heads with the U.S. Open when she didn't want to speak to the journalists after her match. And, you know, just some history, those kind of player agreements started because the U.S. Open and other tournaments realized, hey, the athletes are what people want to see. Being able to talk with the athletes and having that reporting with the athletes helps us bring in sponsors. It helps us bring in reporters, and it makes people watch the matches. When Naomi Osaka realized, hey, I don't need these press conferences to connect with an audience anymore. I don't need this to sell my shoes or do anything. She moved to social media. And that's exactly that autonomy and those opportunities that we're talking about for the dumb athlete. I really think a lot of that comes from digital media. It comes from independence. You no longer have to trust a bigger sports arena, a bigger landscape. And so I think that's also a huge takeaway for sports organizations today, is how do we change that power structure?
Now, let's talk a little bit about trust, because trust isn't a one-way street, mm-hmm. right? Like back in the day, you know, coaches expected athletes to just magically trust them because they were in charge and to do what they said and to trust that good things would happen in the end. Same thing with sports organizations. They trusted the athletes to do what they needed to do, the coaches to do what they needed to do, for marketers to get, you know, the word out and to, you know, get butts in seats, and for ticket sellers and, you know, anyone and everyone had their specific role. But, you know, you brought up Naomi Osaka, and well, she didn't have to do this because she could still make it on her own. Shouldn't coaches and leaders of sports organizations and the sports media trust that she will still come out and do what's expected of them on top of her being able to do it on social media? Where does everyone kind of fill out with that?
That's an interesting question. And I won't be so proud to say that I know for 100% fact the solution, but I'm willing to give it a try. And if people have any more thoughts, I'd love to hear in the comments or maybe on social media what you guys think. The first thing I actually think about is the relationship between all of these groups and that power dynamic. You would say, oh, well, you know, the U.S. Open still is thinking that, you know, Naomi would in good faith help them out and explain that. And you might think on the other side, like Naomi might think on the opposite end, that the U.S. Open is going to do their best to make sure that the reports that end up coming out are positive about her, and that they respect how much time she needs between a match and being able to talk about this, or that they will field some of the answers. Like, I think if you went back and looked at some of those reports and interviews and different, you know, the different thoughts going on during that time, that's kind of what the basis was. And that's what I would suspect as an athlete. I've been interviewed after bad games before too, where I'm like, hey, I don't want to do this. Like, there's no trust here. And I think that's the other thing, again, with the dumb athlete is over, is organizations not just assuming that the athlete will do this out of blind trust and good faith, but also educating them to say the impact that it has. So if the U.S. Open can explain to Naomi, maybe they do, maybe they don't, but they have player education that says, hey, we ask you to do this. It's a requirement in your contract, but here's the reasoning. The reason is because it brings more attention to the tournament, and it does all of that. You may still have athletes who don't care and are like, no, I want to do my own thing. I don't care about the tournament. I can play wherever. But I think you would have a lot of people who would still participate in it. A great example I've been on podcasts and panels with NIL other athletes talking about NIL, especially football players. And they talk about how important it is for them to have revenue share. And they bring out all these numbers about, you know, we make all this money for the school. We deserve a percentage of it. Every football player, when I brought it, like kind of broke it down to them and said, hey, yeah, you do make this much revenue, but almost all the revenue you bring in pays for the other sports to be able to compete and contribute. Would you consider maybe lowering the percentage of revenue share that you get to make this possible for your peers? They're always open to it, right? They might be like, oh, it sucks. I'm going to make a little less money. And there might be the one-off person who doesn't care. But the overall education of the entire system also makes a huge difference. Have you kind of seen that too?
No, I have. And other guests we've had on, whether it's, you know, here on the Culture and Sports Podcast or on Culture Roundtables or even our annual leadership summit, we've had these discussions a lot. And I think people inherently are reasonable, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you take the time to explain something to someone, I think people are a little more open to not only the why behind the question, but also where that question, where that situation is coming from. And so, you know, back in the day, and I'm sure you had coaches like this, you know, who told you this, you know, they were telling you to do something on the court or in a different sport, you know, back when you were younger, and they said, do this. And you're like, why? And the coach just said, because I told you to, because I said to do it, just go do it. And I think as an athlete, you're less involved in the process. You understand less. If you understand the intent and the reasoning behind something, like I think athletes will perform at higher levels. Yeah. And they'll anticipate things that they need to do because they understand the why behind something. Where I'm going with this is that you can also look at this at the organizational structure, you know, whether it's a team or if it's a sports organization or it's a college or university, whatever organization you want to look at. If employees or athletes understand the why behind something, I think they will do a little bit more. I think they will understand more. I think they will give more. I think they will try to help the organization get to where they want to go if they understand the why behind something. Or you can have the flip side of it. I don't know why I'm doing this. I think I'm doing the right thing, but I don't know if I am. So should I really give 100% to this? And I think as people are still having this discussion with NIL and we're seeing all these things like, you know, house settlements, discussions in sports media, you know, discussions in forums like this, people are discussing it and people are having better ideas of what that looks like. Because I think when everything first started, a lot of people were like, oh, well, the athletes just want money and they don't care how much money is put into them. But I think now people are starting to see, well, you know, when someone finishes high school, do they really have to go to college? You know, should they just go out in the workforce? Maybe they should go to a trade school. Maybe they should just go to college, university solely for education and not to compete. And so athletes have more choices now. Just like coaches have more choices, athletes now have more choices. Organizations have actually more choices than they did before. And I know a lot of people don't believe that, but everyone has more choices now. They could go where it is they want to go. They can make agreements on their own terms or a joint agreement between an organization and an athlete or organization, a coach or a coach and athlete, where people are giving a little bit on each side. Mm-hmm. And I think that works out great. And I think that also builds trust, in all honesty, is that if I'm explaining to you as a leader the why behind something, I think you will not only understand more and try harder, but I think that there's an element of trust that goes into it because I'm taking the time to explain something to you.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I would even go as far to say that if you think that, you know, we're being too soft about this and we're being too rah-rah, that there's, like you're saying, there's active examples of this going on. You know, it's not just the right thing to do. It's also starting to become a competitive advantage. You look, as I think the women's sports are doing this fantastically. Look at The PWHL, the Professional Women's Hockey League, that started 1 or 2 years ago. I think they're on their second season. They started the league right out with a collective bargaining agreement, one of the first leagues to ever do so. Unrivaled Basketball, that's being led by two of my mentors. They started right out the gate giving athletes, you know, a percentage of the overall league and having a say in how the league's going. I think Athletes Unlimited also gives athletes a percentage of revenue, like, from the very beginning. Athletes are leaving traditional leagues and opportunities to take the risk to go other places, and it's working out great. I mean, the WNBA and Unrivaled, I think, is a great example if you want to look more into that. They've created a structure where, what, it's a 6 or 2 month season or so compared to the, you know, 6 or 7 months that you're playing in the WNBA, and you're making right about how much you'd be making through your whole year, you know, at the WNBA. They're making a smaller arena where, you know, you have better connections with the fans, a better atmosphere, you have longer breaks, you have more people on the team to give you a rest. And then the actual, you know, the big prize money is as much as your WNBA salary in a year. It's amazing. There's an opportunity for, on both sides, for athletes themselves, but also for new companies or new organizations who want to tap into them.
You said earlier that you were a fifth-year player for volleyball, for collegiate volleyball. You did your undergraduate and then you went into a graduate program. Can you explain a little bit more of why you were able to do 5 years and why that fifth year happened originally?
Yeah, so I was a senior in high school when COVID first started and everyone went home. And so going into our freshman year of school at Cornell, the Ivy League canceled our season. So we didn't compete. So I was given an extra year of eligibility from the NCAA. And then going into kind of my senior year at Cornell, I had the option to either take a semester off and come back this past fall and compete, or to just enter the transfer portal and do a graduate year somewhere else. The Ivy League didn't allow grad students to compete. So I just decided I thought it would be best to just go ahead and get a second degree rather than delay my current education. I knew I was on track. And it's funny that you ask that, because I think a lot of student athletes, actually I know a lot of student athletes who had a similar experience, whether it was, you know, people actually that were at the Ivy League who didn't have the opportunity to continue playing and just decided to get their grad degree, or just people who stayed at their actual university and got a graduate degree. So also kind of an ironic thing about athletes, you know, being dumb or different things. We might leave this 5-year period and see that athletes might have, you know, maybe some of the most degrees in our age group, you know, especially football players who usually have also a redshirt year on top of maybe that COVID year.
But talking about redshirt years and their regular years, are they doing it because it's taking them longer to complete their degrees? Or, I mean, are even a lot of football players completing degrees? Like, let's talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact data for football completion rates with their programs, but I would say, I mean, probably I can think of just 5 people right now that I graduated with at Cornell that were football players who decided to, you know, get their master's using this NCAA, you know, extra COVID year of eligibility or kind of that kind of thing. And then I would say, yeah, I mean, a lot of people for the most part are using it to get their master's, especially volleyball players. I know some girls who had to redshirt from an injury and then also had the COVID year, and now they're actually in their 6th year and they have 2 master's degrees, right? So this has really been kind of a sneaky opportunity for student athletes to get education, the formal education that we know, but then also to take advantage of the growth of NIL. My freshman to junior year, NIL was allowed, but it wasn't as robust as it is now. So just between my senior year and especially just this extra grad year that I had, I've been able to take advantage of so much of that and honestly learn so much about the industry that I eventually will work in.
Now, let me ask you a question. So a lot of people think that, oh, you know, you're going to school, you're going to practice, maybe you're doing some weights, You know, and you're resting and eating and you're doing all these things to be an athlete and a student. But it's a little more in depth than that, right? Like, don't you have 8 million meetings to go to and 8 million practices? And, oh, by the way, somewhere you have to fit some sleep and somewhere you have to fit eating a few times a day. And, you know, you need to see physical trainers and just make sure you stay healthy. And then maybe have a little bit of social life. But somewhere in there, you're also finding a way to put yourself out there on social media and talk to the regular media as well and make connections. How do you have time to do all this? And what does a normal day look like for you?
I would argue that I don't. And that's probably my first problem. but like you're saying, yeah, it's different. I mean, I would say even just my schedule at Cornell versus when I kind of took the step up in conference to play in the ACC at Syracuse for volleyball was very different. Like at Cornell, they really prioritized our athlete or our academic status above everything, like even over sports. Mm-hmm. And so like we practiced in the mornings because tutoring and all the academic events happened in the afternoons. And so that was kind of a non-negotiable. And then moving to Syracuse, we still prioritized our education. I still have an academic advisor. I would say I have probably a little bit more athletic support with academics here. But it's just different. We travel all across the country, whereas Ivy League, we were always busing. We do have more meetings. We have required, you know, lifts and required training and different things where I will say at Cornell was a little bit more flexible, especially with the training room and, like you're saying, treatment. But it really does vary across all sports. And I would say in not just Division I or conference, but also the actual sport that you play and the program that you go to, which is why on my podcast, I talk to athletes so much about making the best decision for them and looking into what they really want. But yeah, it's a big undertaking. I think the biggest part of it too is more of the mental energy rather than the actual time on the calendar for me has been realizing just because I technically have time right now doesn't mean I can actually get something done. Does that kind of make sense?
No, that definitely does make sense. Now, talking about time, and we could add space into there, right? Like you need time and space as an athlete to recover, you know, whether it's recovering from a practice, recovering from injuries, you need time to and space to do all these different things, you know, to learn, you know, to, you know, work with your teammates, to work with academic advisors or professors, even to work, you know, you need time and space to work like personal things like family and friends and relationships and things like that. What do you think about the need for time and space for an athlete to include time and space to potentially just zone out?
Yeah, I think it's definitely needed. I mean, I think that's also where a lot of athletes sometimes get pigeonholed into specific majors or different activities because, you know, their advisors or their coaches recognize the commitment that they have with their sport. You know, like a lot of people will kind of recommend like, hey, don't do a STEM major, don't do architecture, something that's very demanding on top of a very demanding athletic schedule. So I think it really comes down to having a support system and have whatever organization that you're in that understands your athletic, you know, priorities and all of the things that you have to do as well as your academic priorities. And really as a student athlete, those are kind of your two things. And then the social and all of the rest and all of that kind of comes third, and you kind of know that when you're signing up. And I do think that there's a lot of information and advice online and just in general for athletes about that when they're entering college. But it is just something that you have to work through for yourself once you actually get there.
Right. And this goes more into the evolving athlete, right? So not just the dumb athlete anymore. I would have to imagine back in the day when athletes were told not to choose STEM or architecture majors like you brought up, to do something simple like underwater basket weaving. So they're being told to do that. I'm sure that was part of the reason why athletes just didn't complete their degrees, probably because there wasn't a lot of interest in the subject matter that they were studying. I'm sure in the 10,000 meetings they were in each day took the majority of the time. And I think over the years, you know, colleges and universities and coaches have definitely changed that, you know, not to where it's 100% great, but I think, you know, coaches and teams and organizations have also evolved along with athletes. Have you seen that even just in the last 4 or 5 years that you were in your collegiate volleyball career? And do you see a great pathway forward where not only is the athlete continuously evolving, but also coaches, teams, and organizations?
Yeah, and I'll say from my perspective, I think a lot of it has been athlete-led, actually. Like athletes finding things that they're interested in and maybe being more willing to ask questions about it and whether they can go ahead and do that. I think a great example really is this whole NIL sphere and sports business rising within college sports has created a lot of interest for student athletes and just students in general to pick majors or do activities outside of their sport that are surrounded by that. So like a great example, like I talk to one of my teammates all the time who kind of she wants to be an influencer. She wants to be an athlete creator about, hey, why don't you major in communications? Why don't you take advantage of all these opportunities that are here at Syracuse to learn about social media, to learn about marketing, to learn about all of this? And then, hey, you might get an education so great and learn so much that you don't even have to hire an agent and sacrifice that 10% because you'll already understand the contracts and media and all of that. So I do think that there's been a shift. And also I think because of advocacy and because of we're kind of reaching a new generation of athletes where there's people who went through that and have experienced the consequences of being pigeonholed or being influenced to do other things. They've now kind of grown up and seen what those problems have been and are able to talk to us now. You see so many, you know, big athletes, even professional athletes that we all looked up to when we were kids, now kind of finish their career and figure out what the consequences were. And now they come back and they have their own podcasts and they have their own conversations where they can inspire us or educate us to hopefully pick a different path.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, continuing to talk about just the evolution of collegiate sports specifically, I think it was 2023, huge volleyball game, Nebraska and Omaha. I know you weren't on either of those teams, but how for you, not only as a sport, but for college athletics in general, and for you even as a volleyball player, how do you think that impacted you? And for those listeners who don't know what I'm talking about, Nebraska and Omaha played in what, the largest volleyball all-time attendance record ever at any level. And oh, by the way, it was women, not men. It was over 90 something thousand. It was like 92,000-93,000 fans. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, it was awesome. Like, I mean, as a volleyball player and obviously a volleyball fan, it was so cool to see that. I think my first thought was, I wonder if we could pack Shilcock Field at Cornell for something like that. I think we've got a few years before we're doing anything like that. It's pretty cold by that time of year too, anyway. But no, it was awesome. I think for me, especially at that time, I was really, really, you know, working on the Fair Play for Women Act and a lot of gender equity reform. Like you already said it, that was a women's sport. I think that's really, really cool because volleyball, I would say, is probably, I don't know if I'm wrong, sorry if I'm wrong, volleyball to me is the only sport that I can think of that's women-led, that the growth is women-led. And actually men's volleyball is kind of using women's volleyball as a way to propel itself and to get more fans and to get more people participating in the sport. So to see that for a women's sport was awesome. It really goes to show that the interest is there, that if you invest in it, that people will come and we're able to kind of create our own stars in volleyball as well, whether it's the actual Nebraska team or the individual players who played in the match. So it was awesome. And I think, again, it also just goes to show athletes who are at their school the kinds of things that they can start asking their athletic departments to do and kind of point their fingers at, hey, like you say volleyball isn't a revenue generating sport or that, you know, basketball and football are the only sports that people care about. But 92,000 something people came to Nebraska. Why don't you, you know, take a look at what Nebraska did to make volleyball such a big sport there. And I want to see that at Cornell. I want to see that at Syracuse. So those are kind of my first thoughts about it.
So talking about women athletes and women's teams in general, there's been a lot of changes the last few years. One of the big things that came up in collegiate athletics was the disparity between men's and women's March Madness, mm-hmm. right? You know, this was what, 2022 maybe, where the women were getting poor lodging, poor food, non-existent workout rooms, and lower level stadiums yeah. to play in for the tournament. And the thought process was, well, they're not generating as much revenue. You know, but those things are changing. Just like in, you know, women's soccer, you know, the women's national soccer team, or even, you know, the USA national team for women's water polo, or women's swimmers, or women gymnasts. You know, there's so many prominent women. I mean, come on, you know, track and field athletes. I mean, there's so many great athletes. You know, let's talk a little bit about them. And of course we could talk about the Caitlin Clarks of the world, right? Like, you know, she's awesome. She's doing great things. You know, but there's so many other athletes out there, Naomi Osaka. And then we have athletes like Sydney and Allison Felix. You know, I know, you know, a little bit about Allison Felix. Why don't you talk about her a little bit and what she's doing?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like you said, there's so many women athletes that are stepping out and trying to make the change that they want to see, which I think is really cool. And this is where I think athletes can really come into this conversation. We've talked already so much about how universities can make changes, how sports organizations can make changes, but athletes themselves really have a lot of the power here right now. In the end, at the end of the day, we are the final product. I think it's after high school, sports in general, it's an entertainment industry. And so when you are the product, you can kind of take the things that you've learned and the different ways that you've been treated as educational points and as things to look into and see how you can improve or what you want to do next. I think Allison Felix is a great example of that. First with her company Seiche, her shoe wear, where she's taken, hey, I had to train all the time in shoes that were not made for my foot or for my anatomy. And she created an awesome brand off that. And then also her next company, which is a sports management company and representative. And so she said, hey, I've had, you know, just short history about her. She had, you know, really troubling deal with Nike around the time that she was getting, you know, had her child, and she had a lot of a negative experience with just her pregnancy and different things. But that Nike deal was something that was huge. And she's like, hey, I'm like the best athlete, one of the best athletes in the world, the best track runner in the world at this point. And I'm having a hard time with representation. So I can only imagine right. what athletes that don't have my prestige and you know, my resume are dealing with. And she started her own agency. And there's so many athletes like that. I mean, I know we're taking a step away from women at the second, but even looking at LeBron and what he's doing with his media production and taking control of the narrative, he's giving athletes their podcasts, he's starting his own conversations. There's a lot of opportunities for athletes to create the sports industry that they want to see. And they also, again, just the nature of, you know, what they do and how people look at them, they have opportunities to collaborate and almost take the market share of the brands and the people who they feel like haven't represented them well.
Now, obviously, great things have been happening in sports, not only for women, but for men as well. And I think a lot of the old school ideas are not only disappearing, but they're also being looked at negatively. Like, why did we subject ourselves to abuse for so long, you know, as athletes, you know, as a parent, why did we subject our children to, you know, this type of, you know, mental, physical, or emotional abuse for so long? And we've seen those things happen, and we've seen, you know, positive change. I know that there's organizations that have taken control, like Professional Women's Hockey League, where they're like, we're going to change the standard. We're going to do all these great things. Are there also some organizations, and you don't have to name them, but are there organizations, not only are they unwilling to change with the times and with what is needed, not only from athletes and coaches, but also society as a whole, but are there some who are actually going in the opposite direction? They're actually going to be almost phased out because they're unwilling to do that change?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I definitely think that there's organizations who maybe have reached their prominence based off a specific structure that just isn't going to be maintained anymore, and that they have to be flexible. I mean, I just did an episode on my podcast about the rise of professional women's volleyball, and we were talking about how people have been getting frustrated or showing their doubts that we have so many professional volleyball leagues going on in the country right now, and they don't think that the competition is great. But if you go back to the history of all professional leagues in the U.S., there's always been, you know, a period where that sport was, there were two leagues that were competing, right? Football, basketball, even the WNBA, and it's always been happening. And the league that ends up succeeding is not just the league that's more profitable, but if you take a look, it's the league that the players support the most and that the players actually want to play for. So yeah, I mean, if you're focusing on a specific structure and you're not able to be flexible, you will be phased out, because there's so much opportunity now for new startups and new people coming in this space. I mean, I'm 23 years old. I'm just now graduating with my master's in marketing, and I run a strong business around sports consulting and helping startups and even established brands navigate this landscape. So like, if I can do that, you can only imagine how many people that have been working in the sports industry for this long who have ideas of, you know, that are going to push people out. So yeah, 100%. If people aren't recognizing this and getting on top of it, you know, they won't be here in 5 or 10 years.
Now, some of that is not only taking care of athletes and taking care of teams while they're currently playing, but you're also thinking about like professional off ramps, or even, you know, post-retirement for athletes, that organizations are still involved with these athletes and helping them, explore their futures and moving in the right direction. I know you've seen a lot of that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I love these questions. This is so fun for me to talk about all this. I think a great example is the transfer portal now in college sports. I mean, you take a look at stadiums and courts across the country, they're named after famous alumni. Like our most famous building at Syracuse Athletics is Carmelo Anthony's building that he donated to the basketball programs, right? So imagine a world where Syracuse didn't maintain that positive relationship with Carmelo Anthony. We don't have that facility. We're losing half of our athletic building, you know? So, and that's only going to continue as the transfer portal continues. It's going to continue, you know, as players maybe switch in and out of leagues. Maybe we'll see that in volleyball, right? You won't have those franchise players or those league players, like you could argue like a Michael Jordan and things like that. So yeah, it's something that you definitely have to start thinking about. How are you going to maintain that relationship and the longevity of that relationship? That's a huge part of brand building as well, is, you know, people seeing it over and over again. When you have players constantly switching in and out of your college or even just your professional team, you're not able to build that brand.
So before we finish this episode, I wanted to go over some key points with you. First one is would you agree that the era of the dumb athlete is over?
100%. I hope everyone listening agrees by now too.
And what are your thoughts about athlete identity?
I think it's widening now. It's widening. I think a lot of athletes now maybe don't even think of it just like, oh, that I'm an athlete. I think a lot of athletes now think that I I'm an athlete, I play my sport, and I do this. Even if your whole identity is surrounded around athletics, you might say, oh, I play basketball and I do endorsements in NIL. And that's two separate kind of entities and things that you do.
But do you think that the athlete identity changing is actually making athletes and teams even more competitive and performing at higher levels?
I would argue that it might not. I think we might need to see some more. I think all of these opportunities for athletes to be monetizing and to do different things, I could see a world where it keeps them from performing the same way on the court. And maybe we won't see records and big things happening in sport as fast as we used to. I mean, our mind share is being separated. I won't lie. Like I probably do spend, I've spent less time watching film than I maybe would have if I wasn't hosting a podcast and doing things right. Like that. So I don't know if it makes you less of an athlete, but it is true that all of these different things that athletes are doing now, it might keep you from some levels of performance.
But it's all learning, right? Like, all of this is new. Mm-hmm. This wasn't happening, even 10 years ago. Athletes weren't doing all of their own branding or most athletes weren't. And a lot of this is new. So take some trial and error, right? Like we all have to learn not only as athletes, but as coaches and athletic staff and GMs and presidents and CEOs of large sports organizations. Everyone has to adjust. And not only like do the athletes have to adjust in order to learn and then to be better, but organizations do as well. Yep. They can't just put this all on the athletes, because if athletes are all of a sudden doing all these great things, organizations are probably missing out, right? Mm-hmm. And they, even though at first they were resistant, like, oh, we don't want athletes to do this. We don't want them to have their own name, image, or likeness. But all of a sudden they realize there are great opportunities for sports organizations to jump on board and to make even more money.
Yep.
And so I know change is hard, but in this case, shouldn't we not be afraid of the change of the athlete's identity at this point?
Yeah, I mean, it's changing regardless. So maybe it is okay to be scared, but sometimes you have to do it scared.
So before we finish every episode on the Culture and Sports Podcast, I asked our guests a question. And in this case, you're not a guest, you're the co-host, but we just wanted to start this season with just me and you. But I do ask a guest this final question, and I want you to think about it and respond. If you could talk to any coach, any fellow athlete at any level, sports organization, college, university, national governing bodies, professional sports leagues, if there's one thing you could talk about supporting the whole athlete, what would that be?
I think I'd love to talk to the decision makers at the NCAA who are likely sitting around right now and redrafting their mission statement and how they run and the structure. And I'd love to know just what they're thinking and how it's going to change. I think a lot of people have really negative views on the NCAA overall right now. I just don't think I know enough to make one full, decision, but I'd love to know more about, how do they see their role in college sports changing, and, maybe offer up some insights from a student athlete perspective who also, understands the industry a little bit. That's a wrap for this week's episode of the Culture and Sports Podcast.
We hope this episode has started an internal dialogue, or even one with your team, about the importance and impact of leadership and organizational culture.
This episode of the Culture and Sports Podcast was produced by Sydney Moore and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki. Music by Chase Griffin.
If you'd like to learn more about culture and sports, the Culture and Sports Podcast, or our other programs, go to cultureandsports.com. where there's a wealth of resources, articles, research, podcasts, video shows, webinars, and courses.
Or you can connect with us on all social media platforms at Culture and Sports. Thank you for tuning in to the Culture and Sports podcast.